The thing that irritated Gene was that these people were calling this thing creative art. It's not. It's therapeutic. Here is a person who's off the rails trying to get back onto the rails by means of art. That's artist therapy. But the artist who is on the rails and works out of that sense, that's a totally different thing. Both are perfectly okay, but it's good to know the difference. You don't ask a professional dancer to even know how to handle people who don't want to dance. Dancers are the most terrific artists. Dancing and singing, I think, are the most difficult arts because the body is an instrument. And since it has to be in perfect trim, that's what you're working for all the time.
Audience question. In my mind, I often juxtapose the words hero and artist. They are both on this heroic path and then are finding themselves. That's a goal for both of them. So beyond just knowing the technique, there is that inner spirit that's very important to an artist. Maybe you can say it is that feeling inside, even if it's running down a hill, that is what makes an artist as much as technique.
You're bringing a heretical position here. You get very sloppy out of that sort of thing.
Kennard, in so many societies in the past, women don't seem to have been the artists. They don't seem to have run the societies. Every so often you get a society that is a matriarchy, perhaps where women appear to be in control for 100 years or more. Now what happens there if women are for being and men are for acting?
There are certain fields in the arts, we think of them more as crafts, where women dominated. All of the arts, weaving and basket making, pottery, the certain arts having to do with sewing and embroidery, those are women's works.
Kennard, but do you think men fall in love with women more if women are not doing, but just being?
Oh, that's just a statistical problem. The three ideals of women in traditional societies are the woman as mother and wife, the woman as courtesan, and woman as athletic warrior girl. Those are the three ideals.
Arian, what about Artemis?
There are two kinds of goddesses in mythologies. One is the primary goddess, who's symbolic of the universe, of the earth and heavens and whatnot. She's the total being, total god. The other kind is the goddess who's the consort of a god. When a god-oriented mythology comes in, the whole scene shifts. Whereas in the goddess-oriented mythology, the male is subordinated to her. With the male mythologies, the goddess is secondary. Now Artemis, of whom you asked, is the goddess of the first kind. She comes from the old Bronze Age period, and Martin Nielsen, who's one of the major scholars in the whole field of classical religious mythology, regards her as the total goddess. When a number of goddesses, each of whom is a total goddess, begin to come together, which happens when you have a culture that spreads over a large territory and takes in people of other kinds, the goddesses become departmentalized. That is to say, each is given a certain portion of the goddess's realm to run, to handle. And Artemis is the classical 5th century goddess of the hunt. That's a sentimentalization of the goddess of the wild things, who is herself the goddess of the forest and all the beasts that are in it. In the very early periods, the god and the animal are the same, and Artemis was associated with the deer. She was the deer. The deer was Artemis. And then later, as the human aspect becomes more and more accented, the deer becomes her companion. Persephone and Demeter were pig goddesses. The pig was a tremendously important figure in the Bronze Age. Circe is the one who was transmuted to swine and so forth, and she is the initiator. She initiates Odysseus into the wisdom of the underworld, and the wisdom of the realm of light of her father, the sun. So these departmentalizations of goddesses are reductions, really.
High water. When one looks at Eros and Logos, and let's remember what Socrates or Plato actually said, there are two forms of thinking. One is permanent and fixed and logical, masculine and good, and it's called Logos. The other, Eros, is intuitive and impermanent and not very good and feminine. I think we've been stuck with that connotation.
Arian, we're stuck with that duality. The logos, the logical mind, and the intuitive. That's setting up a duality. And I think what's really necessary is a bridge, that we start creating the new model.
Robert Bly, how do you deal with Joseph's idea that the polarities of life are where the energies lie? High water, that's the problem. We're always talking about reuniting the psyche, but we always talk about the fact that it's essentially a process of making a duality into something else.
Halifax, so long as it's not pairs of opposites only.
High water. Right.
Arian, I think what's really involved here is the process that is associated with that beautiful myth about an individual who has black hair, and he walks with a panther by his side as he is discovering who he is. And as he begins to discover who he is, his hair turns from black to brown, and the panther changes into a leopard. And as he fully realizes who he is, his hair turns fiery red. Then the person pinches the growth marks the leopard got from transforming into a beautiful lion, because he wants the memory of the dark places from where he's come. I think that's the process that we're involved in. I think that there's an emerging now where we're trying to get away from, or pinching, the dualities or polarities, so that we can become something more.
I'd like to say I'm very much for duality. But the problem is how duality gets to be interpreted. Now, in the grandiose mythological systems of the old world mythologies dating from Bronze Age times, we have two quite contrary systems. They appear, for example, in the yin-yang idea and in the Hindu idea of male-female relationships. The woman is Shakti. In Europe and in the China-Japan area, the yang, the masculine, is regarded as the part that is associated with heaven, with solar life, with warmth, with action. And the female principle, the yin, is associated with darkness and moisture and water. It actually is a term that comes from the two sides of a stream, the side that is lighted by solar light and the side that is in shadow. One is dry, the other is moist. But in general, the male is regarded as the active and the female as the receptive. This is something that I think dominates Northern thought in the Eurasian world, both in Europe and in China. As one who grew up and was psychologically conditioned long before blue jeans came in, I have this observation to make. In the old days, the male was dressed in black tie. He was recessive. And the women were beautiful out in front. Now, this was a characteristic of rather recent Occidental civilizations. When you turn to the Oriental or primitive societies, the women, like female birds, are quite recessive, and the men have all the glory. The only place you get this in our society is in the military. But the women, nevertheless, are the ones who wear the feathers and are out in front. Now, this has interested me enormously. The traditional way, and it's the way of animals, as well as what might be called the traditional societies, is that the male is the flowering thing, the glorious thing, and the woman is quite subdued, but is supportive, is the earth. And in those drums that are played in India, the deep-sounding ones, that's the female drum. And the one that goes brilliantly on, that's the male drum. What happened in Western society was that a good deal of the organization of thinking with respect to sex was based on putting the woman forward. You take your hat off, or you used to at least, in the elevator. Or when a woman comes into the room, you give your seat to her. Now the woman begins to dress like a man, and the man's dress hasn't changed. It's just deteriorated and receded into the background. And where the hell are we? We have unisex barbershops. It's ridiculous because the whole energy of life depends on polarity, and when you give that up, all you've got left is a blob. Then you have a shock when you travel to India. You learn that the active aspect of the idea of energy is Shakti, female, and the male is inert. He is the one to be activated. I thought, where did the system come from? Why this complete contrast? They're both perfectly true. One is related to the physical relationship, and the other is the psychological. The male, psychologically, he just wants to be left alone. I've seen it very, very strongly. I don't know how the females are, but God, the best times are when you're just there, kid, and you are where it counts. And then this little twinkle bug goes by, And as Joyce says in Finnegan's Wake in Anna Livia Plurabelle, the little rippling river stream. And she says, oh, wouldn't it be nice to start the world again? And you think, oh, goddamn, it really would. And the male, then, is activated. Now, I think this is perfectly correct. The female is the activating principle, and then she's amazed that you're activated and come at her like that, you know.
High water. Are you saying women never become aggressive?
They're aggressive. It's already there in the twinkle star. It's another kind of aggression. The power of women is psychological and magical, do you see? And their aggression is a magical one. They are perfectly innocent. And oh boy, something's going on, and they say, oh, I'm not responsible, no. I just came here en décolleté, and look what's happened.
Audience question. Joseph, you once said that modern man was kept in childhood for so long that there was a continent full of women in their mid-30s who were unloved and unmatched because their men had not grown up to them. I think that is one of our crises in our civilization today.
Whenever one goes from one social world into another, one gets a real culture shock with respect to the male-female relationship. I remember when I went to India. Now, I had spent years studying Indian philosophy that had nothing to do with boys and girls together. When I found myself in India, I began to think, what the devil does this remind me of? There was never a woman visible, except the street women, the women selling vegetables or whatnot in the street. The women who were the wives of the men whom you were consorting with were totally invisible. You'd see two policemen walking down the street holding hands, but you'd never see a man and a woman on the street together. I began to think, my God, the last time I experienced this was when I was in prep school. There are no women around, just males together. And there's another world, and there's another world. A great shock came to me there in Orissa. So India is a prep school. The women are somewhere else. In Orissa, I was staying in a hotel when I was there with the Indians and being entertained by some young Hindu gentleman. One afternoon, I found myself walking hand in hand on the beach with an Indian, and I thought, if Jean should see me now. I said to him, well, I must thank you for the time that you have given to entertain me here. And he said, oh no, it is so fortunate. It is my holiday. I said, this is your holiday and you are spending it with me, walking on the beach? Why aren't you going somewhere for a pleasant time with your wife and family? Oh, he said, we can't do a thing like that. It would be so complicated going anywhere with my family. So I just knew, my God, there is a total discontinuity between the lives of the males here and the family. This was an amazing experience to me.
Bly. Joseph, can I ask you a question here? You said that you had learned a lot from your female students at Sarah Lawrence about relating to the obsessions of the male to life itself. If you were talking to a young male now in the United States, would you suggest that he try to develop the feminine part of himself or the male part?
I'd say find what it is your life career is going to be and learn to do it well. That would be my information. Whether he's male or female, that's something else again. My whole attitude toward pedagogy is learn a job. And it's not going to be learned in a weekend. You've got to put yourself to it. What it takes to do that is what it takes to live your life. That's been my decision.
Bly, so you come away to what Yeats calls passion. You're interested in finding out what a human being's passion is and then following that?
Yes, let him go ahead and do it. It may or may not involve male or female relationships. Those have to be handled in relation to the trajectory of what he has elected to be his career.
Tarnas, when you were talking about the difference in male and female roles in mythology, I was thinking about how Psyche and Eros met, and how there are many male heroes in Greek mythology and relatively few females, Psyche being an example of the exception. Could you talk about how you see the difference between the two?
Mythologies always deal with traditional social situations. We are in a whole new phase right now. Women are released from the chores of domestic life, which absorbed everything they had. Now, women are able to initiate careers for themselves. But typically in our Western civilization, men have been able to say, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. The women now are released, you might say, for that kind of thing. It creates a lot of problems because the only models they have in their chosen careers are male models. A lot of them lose their sense of what it is to be a woman by thinking that their value is one of achievement, not one of being, and it makes for very important problems.
Tarnas, you're saying that achievement is more male?
Absolutely, right from the very beginning. Just look, for example, at the earliest art we have, the art of the Paleolithic. The female figures are simply standing female nudes. Their power is in their body, and their being, and their presence. Many traditional societies regard magic as being originally the woman's possession, and the men have stolen it or taken it from them because it's a woman's thing. Then look at the images of the male. They are always doing something. They're always representing something. They are in action. Generally, in a primitive culture context, the woman is the one who brings forth the species, nature, and the man is the one who brings forth society. Those are the main polarities, and that comes right down the line.
Favreau, then is the problem in today's society that some women, in attempting to be more achievement-oriented, are actually creating a rivalry between two people trying to achieve at the same time? And that's why their union isn't lasting for any length of time?
The problem is not so much rivalry in achievement as the problem of the husband dealing with another person on the other side of the tennis net, you might say. I have had this experience with my students. You see a student wake up to a whole new life possibility. That's a wonderful moment in teaching when that happens because you see a life career, a life trajectory begin to show itself. Then I meet her 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, 30 years later at the alumni reunions, and you can tell the one whose husband let her develop as a human being. The other possibility is that you see a man who marries and expects a wife. Well, we have the archetype of what a wife is, and it's a very helpful archetype. Both lines can develop, but it's in relationship to the man's career, principally, and the woman's with the children. But when you have two careers in the house and the individual developments are on two, not always, parallel courses, there's a lot of love required. I mean, real pedagogical participation to help the other person to develop as a human being and still hang on to the relationship. The thing that holds them together is making the relationship the top thing. It's through the relationship that the development of each is taking place. And when you make a sacrifice, you are not sacrificing to the other person. You are sacrificing to the relationship. That relationship involves the progression of your own life. So when people think of marriage as a continuous long love affair, then they are bound for trouble because it isn't. It is, in a proper sense, an ordeal. And the ordeal is that of individual development. And if there isn't individual development taking place, well, what's the good of it? When you have a woman identifying with the animus, you get the usual business of the executive female. She has identified herself with the masculine aspect of her own life, and she has lost her femininity. She becomes interested only in achievement. The unfortunate thing about it is that she doesn't realize what her own effects are on her environment. Her human relationship deteriorates all along the line. And then she begins to worry, what the hell's the matter here? I've watched it time and time again. This is what you call an animus woman, a woman animated by her intent to be male. It destroys her life as a woman, and not only that, but all of her relationships.
Kennard, did Tristan and Isolt have individual development?
Now, Tristan and Isolt, this is a 12th century problem. All the societies of the world have had socially arranged marriages, not the individual one. Some of the early primitive people and some of the peasant societies will have that kind of thing. But in the structured society, the family had made all the arrangements. Today in New Delhi, one of the major world cities, when you buy a newspaper, there are columns of advertising for wives, and the advertisement has been put in either by a marriage broker or the family. And the young women don't know whom they are going to marry. I have heard the daughters ask their brother, what is he like? They don't see the person they are to marry until the wedding moment. Well, this still goes on. In the Middle Ages, there was this same situation. Young women in the royal families and the aristocratic families were just political pawns. They would be sent here, there, or elsewhere for all kinds of family relationships.
Favreau, which was politically more profitable.
Yes, and when the church sanctifies this, you hear about two bodies, one flesh, and all that. It was really two bank accounts in one. This aristocratic society there began to feel this was really degradation. And then love came in, and the meeting of the eyes as a much higher and more spiritual experience than marriage, and the idea of l'amour.
Kennard, love was a 12th century invention?
No, but the celebration of love as superior to marriage in the troubadour tradition was. It's at that time in the southern part of France, in the Provençal poetry, that the whole problem of love comes up. And our psychological traditions begin right there, trying to analyze what love is. There was one great poet, Guiraud de Bournay, around the middle of the 12th century. There were many, many discussions of what love was, but Guiraud de Bournay's answer is the one that really epitomized the sense of it all. He wrote, "The eyes are the scouts for the heart, and the eyes go forth to find an image to recommend to the heart. And when the image is found, if the heart is a gentle heart, that's the key word, a heart that's capable not simply of lust, but of love, and those are totally different things, then love is born. As I've said, lust is simply the zeal of the loins for each other. Now, Tristan is the high work celebrating this mystery of love. King Mark had never seen Isolde. Isolde had never seen King Mark. It was Tristan who, when wounded in a battle by a poisoned sword, went to the place where the poison had been prepared and was cured by Isolde's mother, whose name was also Isolde. Then he fell in love with Isolde there. Didn't even know he was in love with her, the silly fellow. He goes back and tells his Uncle Mark what a wonderful woman he met in Dublin. The barons say, well, it's good for the king to be married, so let's send for Isolde. So he goes back to get Isolde with a lot of crazy adventures. Then Isolde's mother prepared a love potion so that the husband and wife would love each other. By chance, on the boat, the couple drinks the love potion, and so they are in love. But this is a person-to-person love affair rather than a social situation. The whole tension of love versus marriage is developed there. Of course, there were other problems. Were they in sin? Now, for a mortal sin, you have to have a grievous matter, sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. If you drink a love potion, there is no full consent of the will. A couple of the poets fixed it so the force of the potion would last only 2 or 3 years. By then, of course, they were in sin. From then on, they had a mortal sin problem. That was something else. Then came the problem of resolving this tension between marriage and love. Amour is the Provençal word for love. Amour. Spell it backwards and you get Roma. So marriage and love are contrary. In those days of Eleanor of Aquitaine and Mary de Champagne and Blanche de Castile and her daughters and so forth, women had these affairs every year, and we have the troubadours' reports of them. For example, some chap would come to the court with a case and say, "I have offered myself to this lady, and she said no. She already had a lover. She said she would take me when she no longer had that lover." So what happened was that the woman got married to her lover after her husband died. Then number two presents himself and he says, "Well, here I am." She says, "Oh no, I love my husband." He says, "That's impossible. That's a contradiction of terms." So he brought the case to the court and the court decided that she had to accept him. The stories of the troubadours are just marvelous.
Brown, are you saying that most people have had a love experience like this?
I'm not going to say everybody, but plenty of people have had this experience. It's not always that falling in love happens to coincide with the most prudent form of accident in your life. It's that continuity between the run of your life and the pull of that life, which the love allure suggests, that interests people in a story like Tristan and Isolde. The solution to this tension in the Middle Ages came with Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parzival. That's where love and marriage were brought together. It was an apple of a story. That's my favorite love story.
Kennard, will you tell us about it?
It's a long story, my dear friends. This Grail romance of Wolfram von Eschenbach, his date was 1215 for this, was really the finishing of this great, great romance. He faced this problem, the tension between Amor and Roma. And that's as it stood in the Middle Ages. Love was a calamity to come into your life because the punishment for it was death. I mean, there was punishment by death for love. There's a wonderful scene in Gottfried von Strasburg's Tristan. After the couple has drunk the potion, Brangien, the maid, who should have been watching the potion, not letting it loose like that into the sea, comes with shock and says to Tristan, "You have drunk your death." And Tristan says, "I don't know what you mean." This anguish was the great thing that the Middle Ages was interested in, the pain of love, which is the pain of life. Your life is where your pain is, you might put it that way, and it was the experience of the anguish that held the essence of life. So he said, "If by death you mean the punishment that will be ours if we are discovered, I accept that. If by death you mean eternal death in the fires of hell, I accept that too." That's a big, potent statement, because those people did believe in hell. The only answer I can think of to that is the wonderful saying of Meister Eckhart that love knows no pain. So that even in hell, if your beloved is with you, it's going to be okay. That was the climate that Wolfram faced when he was working on Parsifal. The medieval overcoming of the marriage-love polarity that is represented in Tristan and Isolde was achieved, really, by Wolfram von Eschenbach in his Parsifal. The Grail romance is that of the god in your own heart, and the Christ becomes a metaphor, a symbol for that transcendent power which is the support and being of your own life.
Joseph Campbell, Mythos 3, The Shaping of the Western Tradition.
Now the problem of the Grail romance is what's known as the wasteland. What is the wasteland? You get a clue from T.S. Eliot in his poem, The Wasteland, 1922. The question is, how is one to turn the wasteland into a land of flowers, with everything coming up roses? The wasteland is a land of people who are living inauthentic lives. They just get a job because they've got to live, and that is rubbish. Where can life come out of this rubble, he asks somewhere. The medieval situation was that people were required to profess beliefs they did not hold, to profess love for people whom they had married and had no love for, and they held positions that they had inherited and hadn't earned. And so it is a context of inauthentic lives. That is what Wolfram saw as the wasteland. Now, how does that get healed? It gets healed through the example of an authentic life. Wolfram started the story with Parsifal's father, Gamuray, a knight adventurer who began to serve the Caliph of Baghdad, a Christian knight serving a Muslim monarch. Wolfram jumped the circle of the Christian tradition and recognized Islam as the sister religion of Christianity. So in the course of Gamuray's service to the Caliph, he came to a place called Zazamankh that was governed by a black princess. Her name was Belkarn. He became her champion and lifted a siege and then became her husband. He begot a son, but before the boy was born, he took what we used to call French leave. He went back to Wales and there was the queen, whose name was Hertzeloid. He won the jousting festival and became her husband, and now he's the husband of two queens. He begets a child on her and then goes back to fight for the Caliph and is killed. The child that was born in the Near East was Firefitz. He was black and white. And the child in Wales was Parsifal. So Parsifal, the Christian knight, has a Muslim brother whom he does not know. His mother decided she didn't want her son to know anything about knights. No more of this nonsense. So she went up to Connecticut or something like that and brought forth her little boy on a farm. And so he knew nothing about knighthood. But he had the spirit and heart, the noble heart of his father. He was a born knight, though he didn't know it. So when he was about 15 or 16 years old, he is out in the fields and he sees three knights come by on horseback. He thinks they're angels. That's all his mother has told him about. So he gets down on his knees. They said, "Get up, you don't pray to us. We're knights of King Arthur's court." He says, "What's a knight? How does one become a knight and get to Arthur's court?" "Oh, it's just down there." He goes back and tells his mother, "I want to be a knight." So she faints. Then she decides she's going to fix him. She makes a fool's costume, and he goes trotting off. She trots after him down the road, and when he turns the corner, she drops dead. That's the way his career begins, by killing his mother. It's not a good start. And so, there he goes, riding all day. At night, the horse pulls up at a little rural castle. The knight whose castle it is has lost 3 sons in jousting tourneys. But still, he has his little daughter there with him, so you can see the situation. In comes Parsifal, whom they think is the great and famous Red Knight, and they greet him. Of course, when the time comes to take off the armor and give him a bath, he's all covered with rust inside, and when they remove it, here's this fool. But this old boy, his name is Gurnemanz, recognizes good man flesh and sees a great boy here. So he takes him on and teaches him the rules of knightly combat, how to maneuver horses, the rules of combat, and one of the rules is a knight doesn't ask unnecessary questions. That turns out to be a bad bit of news later on. Gurnemanz recognizes that he'd like to have him as his son. So in a very pretty scene, he offers his daughter as a wife to Parsifal, so that he would have another son and the girl would have a husband and all that. Parsifal thinks, I must not be given a wife, I must earn a wife. And that's the beginning of the new philosophy, you see. He breaks away from the idea of just accepting things that are given to you by society. In a very delicately handled scene, these two part. He rides away, now a changed knight. He lets the reins lie slack on the horse's neck. Now, this is a major image in medieval mythology and other mythologies as well. The horse represents the nature power, and the rider represents the controlling mind. The slack reins means that he's riding nature, his own nature. It's a noble horse who has the same heart as he. The horse carries him all day, and in the evening he comes to a castle that is in some distress. It's the castle of a little orphan queen. She's just his age, and her name is Conduiramur, from Conduiramur, guide to love. When he arrives, of course, his armor's taken off. He's given a nice bath and soft robes and so forth, and presently it comes time to retire, and he's given a bed. Well, in the middle of the night, he wakes up and sees she is kneeling by the bed, weeping. And he says to her, just what the knights had said to him, you don't kneel to me, only to God. If you want this bed, I'll go over there. And here's what she said. If you'll promise not to wrestle with me, I'll just get in and tell my story. And Wolfram says, but she's dressed for war. She was wearing a transparent nightgown. So she gets into bed, and she's crying, and she tells him her story. My castle is under siege. There's a knight, Clamide, the greatest knight in the world, who wants my property and me as his wife. Now there's the old medieval thing again. She also is resisting, do you see, as he resisted. But, she says, you've seen how high the towers are in my castle. I would rather throw myself from the highest tower into the moat than to marry this man. The knight has sent an army with his great general to conduct the affair. And Parsifal says, well, I'll kill him in the morning. And she says, that'll be just fine. So in the morning, the drawbridge goes down and vroom, down comes the Red Knight riding, and he collides with the seneschal, the leader of the king's army, and presently the enemy is on his back, and Parsifal has his knee on his chest and rips his helmet off, and is about to cut his head off when the man says, I yield. Parsifal says, okay, you go to Arthur's court. Tell them you are my man and I sent you. After a couple of affairs of this kind, King Arthur's court begins to think, say, that was some chap that we let go. So they later decide that they're going to go out and try to find him. Parsifal comes back into the castle, and Conduiramur's has put her hair up in the way of married women. So there's a spiritual marriage. Each has chosen the other voluntarily, and he has chosen a wife indeed, and then they go to bed that night. As Wolfram says, not many a lady nowadays would be pleased with that night's sleep, because he didn't even touch her. He knew nothing about these things. 2 days and 2 nights more, they are happy in this way. And then, on the third night, he remembered how his mother had told him of embraces, and Gurnemanz, too, explained to him that husband and wife are one. So then, as Wolfram says, if you will pardon me, they interlaced arms and legs and felt that this is as it should have been going all the time. Now, the idea there is that the physical is the consummation of love, and the sacramentalization of the physical is the love. There's no clergy involved here at all. Love is fulfilled here in marriage, and marriage is the consummation of love. This just threw the whole thing into a new perspective. There were five virtues of the medieval knight: temperance, courage, loyalty, courtesy, and love. And this young man is endowed with them all.
Favreau, what effect did the story you told have on Europe at the time it was written? Was it read by many people, or was it just something that you feel had an effect just through your study of mythology?
There was a great, great wave of Arthurian romance, first with the appearance of Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain in Latin. This was an account of the legends of the kings of Britain before the arrival of the Anglo-Saxons, starting with a hero named Brute, after whom Britain is named. King Arthur appears there as a fighter against the Anglo-Saxons when they're coming in. This sprung a whole tide of stories having to do with the Celtic heroes and Celtic themes. Now, the importance is not so much that this particular romance influenced people, but that it is symptomatic of a whole trend in thinking at that time. These romances parried an attempt on the part of Europe to assimilate Christianity. Christianity came from another part of the world. It came from the Near East as an alien religion and was forced on Europe. It's in the 11th and 12th and early 13th centuries that Europe begins to assimilate it. There was a bishop or an abbot, Joachim of Florence, who around the 1200s published a statement of what he called the Three Ages of the Spirit. The first age of the Spirit is that of Judaism and the age of the Father, the preparation of a priestly race worthy to become the vessel of the Incarnation. The second age of the Spirit was that of the Son and the Church, bringing this message to the world. The third age of the Spirit, which is about to dawn in the 15th century, was to be that of the Holy Spirit, the Holy Ghost, where the Holy Spirit will speak directly to teach and the institution of the Church will gradually disappear. Now, of course, this was heresy and was condemned, but it caught on. The Grail Castle is a castle that participates in this new experience. The Grail Knight, whether his name is Galahad or Parsifal, appears in flaming red armor, appears in Arthur's castle at the time of the Pentecost, the descent of the Holy Spirit, so that the Grail Knight is the equivalent to Christ, that is to say, as the vehicle of the Holy Spirit. This whole drift is what is marked in this book, and it's a drift away from the Orthodox Christian pattern. There's an interesting thing about the date of the Tristan story that comes at the end of the 12th century, about 1160 to 1170. It's exactly the same period as the Krishna cult in India, where the god Krishna falls completely, totally in love with a married woman, Radha. Again, it's the rule-breaking, law-breaking thing that the religious ecstasy represents, going past rational bounds into the irrational, complete giving of oneself. And here is the god himself who is involved in this. The principal poem celebrating this is called the Gita Govinda, or the Song of the Cowherd, and it was composed by a young Brahmin who was in love with the daughter of his guru. He represents himself as Krishna and his beloved as Radha, and that's exactly the same period. A century before, or half-century before in Japan, you have the Lady Murasaki's The Tale of Genji, which is a story of love and also the experiencing of the psi of things, the sensitive psi of things, which is the all life is sorrowful teaching of the Buddha. Right across the aristocratic world, from Europe to the China Seas, you have this aristocratic love as a spiritual experience. Now, in Islam, it comes along with the Sufis. In the Arabian Nights, there are lots of stories of absolute love. The woman there is usually a 5,000-dinar girl over whom this chap goes nuts. The whole world is full of this at this time. Now, the Sufis will tell you, yes, Europe got it from them, but they misunderstood it. But this is not what happened. They received it from them, perhaps, but they didn't misunderstand it. They reread it. In the Orient, the woman is symbolic, really, of womanhood. And very often there is a woman of inferior caste, whereas in Europe it was a lady of equivalent dignity socially, and she remained that woman, addressed to as a specific person, not as a goddess. So there was a very important difference. And there's a difference also between the Provençal troubadour tradition and the German Minnesinger, which means the same thing, singers of love. In France, the beloved is usually a lady of high degree, but in Germany, there was this wonderful lyric poet, Walter von der Vogelweide, the greatest lyric poet of the Middle Ages. His poems are full of just lovely, beautiful girls. He says somewhere the word woman is a nobler word than lady. So this medieval idea of love can be inflected in various ways. But from one end of the earth to another, erotic mysticism was in the air in those days.
Chapter 5. The Boon.
The full round, the norm of the monomyth, requires that the hero shall now begin the labor of bringing the runes of wisdom, the golden fleece, or his sleeping princess, back into the kingdom of humanity, where the boon may rebound to the renewing of the community, the nation, the planet, or the 10,000 worlds.
Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. In 1943, on the suggestion of his friend and mentor Heinrich Zimmer, Joseph Campbell was invited by the Bollingen Foundation to edit and write a commentary on its first publication, Maud Oakes's Where the Two Came to Their Father, a Navajo War Ceremonial. This, he said, brought him full circle back to Buffalo Bill. The following year, he published his first major work, a collaboration with author Henry Morton Robinson, A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake, as well as a folklore commentary to The Complete Grimm's Fairy Tales. Zimmer died of pneumonia in 1943, and Campbell took on the painstaking task of editing Zimmer's American Lectures, a 12-year project that produced 4 volumes of Indian art and mythology. Campbell was also at work on the book that would earn him the devotion of students and artists and the scorn of many academics, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Published in 1949, it won an award from the National Institute of Arts and Letters for contribution to creative literature and became the most popular book in the Bollingen series after Richard Wilhelm's translation of the I Ching. During the 1950s and 1960s, in addition to teaching at Sarah Lawrence, Campbell edited the Portable Arabian Nights, the Masks of God series, and 6 volumes of the Aranos Papers from the Young Conferences at Bollingen, served as president of the Creative Film Foundation, and wrote numerous academic articles and book reviews. Brown, can you describe your early days as a writer?
I was learning so much and experiencing so much in my reading that although when I had been in prep school I had intended to keep on with writing, I had no ambition to write. I was just reading, reading, reading. When Finnegan's Wake came out in 1939, I had already found it when I had been in Paris. It had been appearing in Eugene Jolas's Transition magazine in an earlier version under the title Work in Progress. I had become fascinated in the material at that time because it meant something to me. So when the book came out, I immediately bought a copy and spent the first weekend reading it through. And oh, it was a grand, grand experience reading Finnegan's Wake and being more or less ready for it. In my days at Columbia, when I used to be running around, I got to know a young professor named Henry Morton Robinson, who used to come out and kick a football around the field. I had known him for many, many years, and when I went up to Woodstock in the middle of the Depression, there was my friend, Rondo, as we called him, without a job and with a family, sweating it out. Finally, he broke through and got a job with Reader's Digest, ghostwriting 3 or 4 articles a month, and so he was a real pro in handling writing. So one day, this chap comes down from Woodstock for dinner with Gene and me, and he and his wife. At dinner, he says, "How's it going with Finnegan's Wake?" And I said, "Well, it's going just fine." He said, "Somebody's got to write a key to this thing, and it might as well be you and I." I said, "Oh, come off it." And he said, "Come on, let's do it ourselves." We made an arrangement that we would write an introduction. I started really digging in and pulling it apart, and I wrote from the first page about 40,000 words. When I brought it to Robinson, he said, "For God's sake, what are you going to do, the Encyclopedia Britannica?" I want to tell you something, and anyone who is a scholar may enjoy this message. When you are going to collaborate with somebody, make a very strict line where your authority begins and ends and where your collaborator begins and ends. If you have that line good and clean, then you will end up friends. Otherwise, it won't happen. We had it. Robinson was a good Joycean student, but if it came to a discussion as to what Joyce meant and we were in disagreement, I was right. And if it came to a question about how to write a book, he was right. So I bring him my first statement. He said, "Joe, this is a funny thing to say, but everything is upside down. You say at the end of your paper what should have been said at the beginning, and this goes for every paragraph and practically for every sentence." I went home that night and thought about that, and I thought, this is why. I have been brought up as a scholar, writing for scholars, or wishing to write for scholars. The scholars always tell you what the other fellow had said about this thing, and then they kick him off with one sentence, then they tell you what somebody else said, and they kick him off with another sentence, then they tell you all the difficulties that they have had in finding their thing. Then they come out with this little mouse that comes out of the mouth. And so that's one way of writing. My friend Robinson said, "Listen, when you are writing for civilized people, you are the authority. Tell them in the beginning what you are thinking. Then what you will say will be illustrative of that. They will get the idea first, then they will know why you are writing all the rest of it." Well, that was illuminating. But it has deprived me of a good deal of, what can I say, academic prestige. That makes you a popular writer, you see, instead of the other kind. Well, we worked on the skeleton key for, I guess, about 5 years. And of course, when we had it done, nobody wanted it. We were about to publish the thing ourselves, somehow or other, because we had sent it to Harcourt Brace, which was publishing his works, and they had returned it. Then Thornton Wilder's The Skin of Our Teeth comes along. I went with Jean to see it one Saturday night, front seats, balcony. Oh, my God. What I was hearing was Finnegan's Wake, one line after another. I was just full of the stuff. And so I said to Jean, "Do you have a pencil?" She had a woman's bag that had everything in it. So I had a pencil, and I could just jot down the quotations as they came. I still have the program where I was copying down the quotes from Finnegan's as they came. I phoned my friend Robinson the next morning at Woodstock, and I said, "Hey, Rondo, I think we should write a letter to the New York Times. This is just outrageous. My God, The Skin of Our Teeth is Finnegan's Wake." And he said, "I'll be down Monday, and we'll talk about it." When he heard what it was, he phoned down to the Saturday Review to Norman Cousins. And we worked on the paper that day, and in the evening brought it down to the Review. Cousins looked at it and says, "What should we call it?" "Let's call it The Skin of Whose Teeth?" So we published this. But it was just as the war had broken out, just after Pearl Harbor, and Wilder was in the army. He was a captain. The next thing you know, he was a major. And the next thing you know, he was something more than that. So the newspaper boys came down on us from all angles, just like a bunch of dive bombers. Who was this pair of micks? This wasn't the civilization we were fighting for. "Let's cool it," I said to Robinson. "Wilder's going to have to publish it in book form, and we'll do the job on it then." When the play did come out in book form, I went through it with a fine-tooth comb. There were at least 400 quotations. Every character was right out of Finnegan's Wake, and the problems were out of Finnegan's Wake. And I located a four-line quote, verb for verb, noun for noun. And so we wrote The Skin of Whose Teeth, Part 1, and after that, The Skin of Whose Teeth, Part 2, and that did it. When we completed A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake, I gave a copy to Mrs. Eugene Meyer, and she sent a copy to Thomas Mann. And he wrote her a letter, and that letter is published in the collected letters of Thomas Mann, of which I have a copy. Of course, when I see a thing like that, I look up my own name in the index, and I find that there was a letter about me. This was the letter thanking her for A Skeleton Key to Finnegan's Wake. Whether we listen with aloof amusement to the dreamlike mumbo-jumbo of some red-eyed witch doctor of the Congo, or read with cultivated rapture this translation from the sonnets of the mystic Lao Tzu, now and again crack the hard shell of an argument of Aquinas, or catch suddenly the shining meaning of a bizarre Eskimo fairy tale, it will always be the one shape-shifting yet marvelously constant story that we find, together with a challenging, persistent suggestion of more remaining to be experienced than will ever be known or told.
Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
I had met him, so I knew that he knew who I was. So I'm reading this letter to Mrs. Eugene Meyer, Agnes Meyer, about thanking you for sending me Joseph Campbell's book. I appreciate it very much because I could not possibly myself read Finnegan's Wake. But reading this book, I am confirmed in my suspicion that I have had for some years, namely that James Joyce was the greatest novelist of the 20th century.
Brown. What was the genesis of The Hero with a Thousand Faces? It's my understanding that it was taking form all along, but the actual writing began while you were at Sarah Lawrence.
Robinson was publishing something of his own with Simon & Schuster at that time, and they said, "Who's this guy Campbell?" And Robinson said, "Oh, he's the greatest." So they said, "We'd like him to do a book on myth." So we get a phone call from my friend Robinson, and he says, "Joe, Simon & Schuster's interested in a book on mythology, and if you get up on your high horse and knock him down, I'll never talk to you again." We arranged for a publisher's luncheon, and they said, "Yes, we'd like a book on mythology." "What kind of book do you want?" "We want a sort of modern Bullfinch." I said, "I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole." They said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "I'd like to write a book on how to read a myth." "A sort of self-help book?" "Yeah, okay. Write out a presentation and we'll talk about it." So I went home, Gene was on tour at the time, and I spent one night just typing up a presentation, an idea for a book, and brought it up to them, and by God, I got a marvelous contract. $250 on signing the contract, $250 when the book's half finished, $250 on turning it in. So I worked for 4 or 5 years. It's very gratifying to know that this little book of mine is doing what I wanted it to do, namely to inspire an artist whose work is actually moving in the world. The Hero with a Thousand Faces was refused by 2 publishers. The second one asked me, "Well, who will read it?" Now we know.
Joseph Campbell, Pathways to Bliss.
What it was The Hero with a Thousand Faces. What it is my first lecture to my students at Sarah Lawrence College. And so I wrote the presentation, got the contract, started work on this thing. While I was writing the introduction, I would read it to Jean, as I've read to Jean everything I do. And finally she said, "That's getting to be a pretty long introduction." I went back and checked it over and just divided it into chapters, and I had the first half of The Hero with a Thousand Faces. After 5 years or so, I sent the manuscript up to Simon & Schuster. I didn't hear from them for months. I phoned up and they said, "Our staff has changed since we made the contract and we're not very much interested in the book. We will publish it, but if we publish a book that we don't care for, it's not very good for the book." I said, "Let me come up and talk about it and get the manuscript back." So I got the manuscript back and took it home. I phoned my friend Robinson. You see, I was young and ignorant then, and he was seasoned. And I said, "I've taken back the manuscript and I'm going to send them their money back." He said, "You send them the money and I'll crucify you. You just..." Those bunch of bastards. They have you work for 5 years and then they throw you out.
I embarked on my next Balingen assignment, also at the proof stage, because the original editor had gone abroad. The book was Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, whose galleys I eagerly began to read as I took them home on the subway. An encounter with psychoanalysis made me see significance in every image. The encounter had been Freudian. Some time passed before I realized that the Balingen Foundation had something to do with C.G. Jung, not to mention Paul Mellon. When I met Campbell over the Moorish coffee table as we went through the index I had been commissioned to make, he seemed the easiest person in the world to please, though the index, my first, ventured in directions far from index orthodoxy. The defection of the previous editor had thrown the publishing date out and desolated Campbell, who would have welcomed almost any literate and willing substitute. My enthusiasm seemed to encourage him. When I commented on the aptness of the correspondences he traced between symbolic instances drawn from many mythologies and folklores on one hand and individual dreams and fantasies on the other, he exclaimed, "Yes, you see, it all fits." William Maguire, Ballingan, An Adventure in Collecting the Past.
So then another publisher, Kurt Wolf of Pantheon, said he wanted to see the book. I gave it to him, and he said, "Who'll read it?" He had the grace to tell me some years later. He had also refused Spengler's Decline of the West when it was sent to him. Then I sent it to the Bollingen Foundation, and they cabled, "The hero is a honey, and that's the hero with a thousand faces. It's been out since 1949, and last year, 1984, I'm pleased to say it sold 10,000 copies. That's a pretty good record for a book that was rejected by two publishers, and that's how I got into writing."
Audience question. Is there a basic pattern or list of tricks that you can talk about, since we have to at times be tricked to righteousness? It might be nice to know if there's some repeated patterns that you can identify.
There's a good list of them right here in the Jacob story, and if you want, the best thing that has been done on it is by Joseph Campbell in The Hero with a Thousand Faces. That's the list, and I can tell you, when these things happen to you, and they happen every day, you can read them in terms of the myth, and you know where you are. That's the advantage of being mythologically indoctrinated. You know where you are when these stories take place, and they do. Read them not as something that happened out there, but as something that is going to happen to you and is happening to you. That's translating this material into spiritual food.
Cousineau, when did you first encounter Heinrich Zimmer?
Oh, my marvelous friend, Heinrich Zimmer. I can't say enough about that man. His father was one of the major Celtic scholars of the generation before, and Heinrich was a major Indologist who left Germany when Hitler came in. He couldn't stand what it all stood for. He came over here with his family, and then he couldn't get a job. There were very few Oriental departments in the United States universities at that time. You know how the faculty who's there want to stay there, and they don't want any competition. And so finally the ladies of the Jung Foundation got him a room in Columbia University up on the top of the library, and there he was giving his lectures. I attended the first lecture, and there were four people for Heinrich Zimmer's lecture. He lectured as though he were lecturing to an auditorium. He was a magnificent deliverer of a lecture. I remember him saying to me, "I'm glad you're getting this stuff." One of the other people present was the little librarian who was a person of the Jung Foundation who had arranged for him to be there. Another was a Polish female sculptor who, when she came into the room, emitted a perfume that would have sent all the gods to Amida's paradise. That was it.
Zimmer continued quietly to bring promising Ballingen prospects to Mary's attention. One was Joseph Campbell, a clever and intuitive Irishman, energetic, sound and full of life, who knows a lot about Indian stuff. William Maguire, Ballingan, An Adventure in Collecting the Past.
The next semester, Zimmer had to have a larger room, and the next semester after that, he had an enormous room. And suddenly the man died. He caught a cold, which turned into pneumonia. Nobody diagnosed it correctly. It was absurd. Suddenly Zimmer was gone. I owe everything to Zimmer. His widow gave me his statue of Bodhidharma from Japan when she asked me if I could edit his American lectures. So I spent, God, almost 12 years editing Zimmer's material and brought out 4 magnificent works out of his notes. And in doing so, I became associated with the Bollingen Foundation, the Bollingen people in that whole Jungian world. When I finally wrote my hero, it was refused by two publishers, and it was the Bollingen that picked it up. If they had not picked it up, I don't think anyone here would have heard of Joe Campbell. I'm sure of that. They kept me on course with grants while I edited Zimmer's work and did work of my own editing the Uranos yearbooks. It was that steadying along